Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 from an invisible firebird here in 2023. I think it's a firebird. It might be a thunderbird. I'm not sure. But with me today...
Do you think they know?
They don't know. From your favorite podcast about the film registry, it is... Oh my God. I was literally like, I had this in front of me so that I didn't make this mistake. Missing Out podcast.
Okay.
Mike Natale, Tom Lorenzo are here, surprisingly, for the first time to talk about 1992. There is a whole plethora of films that you guys have your names on my list next to, just to be clear. So we will get to talk about, I don't know, I think it was Universal Soldier, if I'm not mistaken, Tom.
I did the sequel, so yeah.
And Mike, you want to talk about When Babies Get Big, which is totally fair.
Sure. I mean, it's not.
That is certainly a way to put it.
That framing is real odd.
You know, when they blow up a baby.
We're starting great.
Listen, I'm a little punchy. I've been doing some weird fall cleaning in my apartment, so I'm a little bit, but we're talking Sleepwalkers today. Yep. We are talking about one of Stephen King's like original screenplays, maybe one of his only original screenplays, if I'm not mistaken, like did not come from anything he had written before. Does he have
it
another one?
Well, I know off the top of my head, this is the first movie he wrote specifically as a movie, not based on a story or a short story or whatnot. I saw in my research, like there was some weird ass fucking like CBS show that was kind of like an original thing before this. But yeah, this was the first real go at it as a screenwriter. And guys, I got to say, knocked it out of the park.
He is in a scene with Clive Barker. Sorry, I mean, that's
is it okay if we, you know, if we pull back the curtain? We were discussing this before we got on mic, but is it okay if we pull back the curtain and explain how in God's name we wound up talking about this, right?
Well, I know what happened. Mom's not home, so Phil has the house to himself. So he invited the two kids on the block that go to a trade school and can get natty ice, and they decided to watch weird horror movies.
That's not right.
The amount of times we have compared ourselves to Phil's friends from town that go to a trade school is troubling. Okay, so you mentioned like this is the first time we've done 1992, and that's true. for a while, you know, what we were doing and how we were talking, you know, for no particular reason was a little touch and go. We don't need to get into it. It was like when the Minions wound up in that cave for like 40 years and Minions are like, we just don't want to deal with this. So they just missed a lot of history. That was it. We just missed a lot of history. But nevertheless, you reached out and you're like, guys, let's do it, right? Let's talk about something. And you sent us a list of 5 titles. Because you said, you know, Emily's not going to be here. You guys should come on for that. And then clarified, that's not like I'm saying that, you know, I don't want you there when Emily's here. It's just that we have, it's just let's do it. So you sent us 5 titles. And I think it is fair to say, you weren't, the list of titles were not amongst perhaps. Okay.
So can I defend myself a little bit here, Mike?
Just because I know there's nothing to defend. I think it's a smart call.
I'm going to pull back the curtain as you, the aforementioned curtain that you mentioned earlier, Mike. So, you know, for our listeners, as you know, listen, these are all recorded out of order. So who the hell knows when this episode is going to drop? But at a certain point, you know, during our podcast, we made it clear that Emily and Libby got staffed on Yellow Jackets, which is amazing. And I could not be more thrilled for them. They also have an infant. Mm-hmm. Could not be more thrilled for them.
Emily is that also infant has going to get big, and can Mike watch?
No.
Listen, fair. I mean,
yes, she will get big. No, Mike cannot watch. So what happened was, and then on top of everything else, Emily has 2 books. Mm-hmm. So Emily is just spread very thin right now. Boo-hoo. But no, for real. She's very busy, and that's great. So I suggested to her, I'm going to take a group of films from 1992 that I'll do alone. Movies that, quite frankly, she was not all that particularly interested in talking about, shockingly, or just felt didn't have a ton to bring to the table. So she was like, we went back and forth and we came up with like kind of a batch of films. I sent that batch of films to you guys. Now, admittedly, these are not top tier movies. These are not the top tier 1992 films. And I don't want you to think less of that. But here's the other thing too. And I know you're going to think this is a backhanded compliment. It's the truth, which is that I enjoy talking about dog shit movies with you guys. Mm-hmm. Every now and then we talk about great films too. You know what I mean? We've talked about some really good movies too. But I just felt like you guys were the right guys to come on to talk about these movies and we'd have a good time talking about it. So I hope that's okay.
Oh, of course. I just want to clarify, by the way, I think, you know, the other element of that, of course, that I felt when I read those titles was that, you know, you look at all of those and like A River Runs Through and all that. And I do think, you know, because Tom and I both work as journalists, right? Mm-hmm. And we know that, like, oftentimes your editor will turn around and, like, if you write a piece that, like, generates a lot of angry comments or generates a lot of tension in the email, they're going to go, all right, let's pull back the throttle and let's just try, like, a non-controversial topic. Mm-hmm. Our last meeting, maybe a bit tense. So I looked at that and I went, oh, this is smart. There's no chance that we're going to get on here. And just going, how dare you besmirch?
I mean,
runs through it is powerful. Like, it's not, it was.
I mean, here's the other thing, too, which is that, like, so I had never seen Sleepwalkers before. Mm-hmm. I had my notions about this film just based on what I had sort of gleaned about
and
this movie.
They were not even close to what you could have expected.
Okay. They kind of weren't, if I'm being completely frank. Like, this is not really what I thought it was going to be.
I rewatched this shit last week, and when it ended, I was just like, oh my God, I wish I could have been in the room with Philip Iskov as he watched this delusionally deranged, horny, weird fucking cat people movie.
I mean, this
watched Paul Schrader's Cat People and was like, hold my saucer of milk.
I mean, the weird part of it for me, and we'll unpack this further, but like, is
just
the,
one?
The, well, there's a lot, but like, the tone of this movie is so fucking strange. Like, I really don't really know that they know, like, I don't know that anyone knows what kind of movie they're making.
Well, listen, here's the thing that I feel like we need to get out of the way front, which is that Mick Garris is a terrible filmmaker. And I hate saying it like that because I said it to friends that I know in the industry that, like, know him. because he's a nice guy. I listen to his podcast. He's a great interviewer. He, you know, he's a great producer doing Masters of Horror, what, like 15 years ago and shit. Like all the work he's done behind the scenes and all of that, more power to him. Love the guy. But Jesus Christ, I've seen a bunch of his work and it is, when this is, and I'm not even being funny, like this is by far the best movie he's ever made. The best thing he's ever made.
Well, what's strange about what you're, I agree with you 100%, but also is that Stephen King, so originally this film is offered to Rupert Wainwright to direct. And Stephen King specifically says, fuck that guy. I want this guy. I want the guy that did Psycho 4.
Psycho 4 and Critters 2.
Like, this is the guy.
Yeah, and that, the crazy thing is, he comes up with that idea of, like, well, the idea of this movie, but also, let's get the Critters 2 guy, and this isn't his cocaine era. He's clean. He's sober as a fucking bird.
Yeah, but I think...
That's crazy.
I think that with this, because I think about it, because I'll up this one, Tom, huge Stephen King fan, unabashedly.
Well, I want to talk about that, too.
Yeah, okay. I less so, because my attitude on Stephen King... is similar to it, this film is emblematic of my attitude on Stephen King.
Okay.
Which is, I truly believe that Stephen King would be not just amongst the general public, but even among like literary scholars, would be considered one of America's great writers were it not for the fact, like, we're all writers here, you know, to one degree or another.
Sure.
Every one of us has a notebook full of potential screenplay ideas or novel ideas, right, that we jot down. And there's a number of them that like a week or two later, like we look at and go, I don't know if this is working. Or we share that idea with somebody and they go, I'm not sure about that. Stephen King achieved such success so quickly that that it all goes to print. And like there is an apparatus around that knows that like his name on something will sell. And I think that there's so many kind of mid-tier things that he does that diminish the brand, right? Like, because you go back and you read Carrie, right?
Well, so
and it's that's undeniably like that should be in the conversation of like one of America's great horror works.
Well, this is actually the end of his first run of delivering great work. He had a run, he came out of the gate with Carrie, and then he went on an insane run through all the, you know, we made the joke, but like through all the drugs and alcohol issues, he put out banger after banger, a misstep here and there with some bullshit like the Tommyknockers or whatever. But up until
Tommyknockers specifically, yes.
Well, yeah, that is the worst in that run. That's like his Memoirs of an Invisible Man. But, you know, up until 92, when he, in the same year, he does Gerald's Game and Dolores Claiborne, and you go, this guy still got it. Okay, great.
I just pause you for one quick second, Tom, just for what it's worth, because it's funny that you said Memoirs of an Invisible Man, because we literally had the King Cast guys on for Memoirs of an Invisible Man a few weeks ago, which I think is just hilarious that confluence. But I also just wanted to say, and then I'll let you finish. I didn't mean to cut you off, but I'll just say I read my first Stephen King book. I've never read any of his books before because, spoiler, I was a big baby. I know both of you know that. I'm a big scaredy cat. So while all my friends were reading all the Stephen King books in high school, I was off, I don't know, doing other things that didn't scare me. So I have lots of friends who are really big fans of his, and I've seen a lot of Stephen King movies, but I never actually sat down to read one of his books. And I read 11/22/63, which might be one of the best books I've ever read. And I say that with
wholehearted. Amazing book, yeah.
I mean, it's a fucking stone cold masterpiece. And as I was reading it, to your initial point, Mike, I was reading it, and as a writer, putting my writer hat on, just being like, this guy fucking understands how to write books that are propulsive, books that have heart, books that are scary, books that are hard. Like, it's just, he's really just firing on all cylinders in that book. I'm sure that he's written books that are not as good, but it's like, as a writer, I was just truly just fucking blown away by it.
I think that kind of plays into what's going on with this movie, because he is such a good writer. And after this, he starts dropping books that are bad or forgettable or whatever. But I think honestly, the
was
kind
this
of,
after the car accident? I'm trying to remember what
this was before. The car accident was 99. So okay. I mean, the car accident leads into another string of like right. bad books, like
because he's hooked on painkillers, right?
Well, he's hooked on painkillers, but he also wrote fucking Dreamcatcher in the hospital, and so. Yeah, so
Dreamcatcher,
like,
everyone's favorite book about butt aliens, right?
Well, because he said, like, I was in the hospital and I was having digestive issues, and I just thought, what if my shit was an alien? And it's like, all right, Steve, enough with the perks, bro.
I think
like,
that I'm underlines not- Mike's point of this is maybe someone should say no.
But that's, I think that but is, I think yeah. the big problem is that he writes Christine, and Christine is a great book. Legit, it's probably in my top five of his books he's written, and it's a stupid fucking idea. Yeah. What if my hot rod was possessed by a demon and it turned a nerd into like a greaser from, you know, like the 50s, and like you just go, what is this? No wonder you find out the guy was fucking doing eight balls in every fucking 5 minutes.
And it's also this thing of like, honestly. And Phil, I don't know like the breadth of like everything you've gone through in your career. I can only speak to myself and what I know, you know, what sure. Tom's gone through, but I'm sure you've gone through it to one degree or another, which is as a creative person, right? One of the things that overcoming a fear of rejection is obviously important, right?
Sure.
But you still need to have a little bit of kind of fear of rejection. Because otherwise, yeah. you're just going to think every idea is great. And the Absolutely. Worst thing is, I know, you know, as from a journalistic standpoint, Tom and I have both gotten into positions where the people who are supposed to be our overseers, our editors, mm-hmm. the people who maybe push the stop button, stop pushing the stop button and kind of just go, whatever you want to do.
Yep.
And it's never been something so destructive. It's never just, but it, like, you know that feeling. And like Tom and I have talked about it a number of times where like we look back on some of the things that we did or we wrote and got published and went, oh, somebody probably should have stepped in at some point. Right. And I think that King's issue is that he is an industry, right?
Sure. He's too big to despite, fail. Yeah.
Despite being a gifted writer. And it's like, you know, it's almost the George Lucas problem of like,
also, that's why I'm saying, that's why I'm saying Christine is kind of the thing that made him think he can do anything. Because he had a great run up until Christine and even after Christine. But everything in this run, you understand, like, as a story, it's not so crazy out there. But
was
Christine,
Cujo after Christine?
Cujo is after Christine, yes. Cujo is the book he doesn't remember writing because he was so coked out of his mind.
But the other thing, too, that's worth noting is everything that has his name attached to it sells. And that's why I'm talking about the brand thing, right? Is like, regardless of whether it's good or not, right? And we see this a lot, I think, in the film industry in general now, is how many like filmmakers, right, get to the point where like they get attached to a million projects and they're all like IP projects, because it's just like, well, you're a brand and you have everybody around you is telling you this is the next great idea. You're the perfect guy to do this. You're great. They don't have anybody saying no. In the case of King, like it kept making money.
Well, I think that there's also. I agree with you, and I kind of want to add a caveat to this as well, which is, and I say this with all due respect, because as I just said before, I think Stephen King has the potential to be a truly brilliant writer. He's not a great screenwriter. And
no,
screenwriting
he's
not.
He's terrible.
It's very different than writing a novel. Yeah. And he's also not a good director. From what I've heard, Maximum Overdrive is not very good.
It is Sleepwalkers level delightful.
Phil, I need you to know one person on this call literally owns a piece of Maximum Overdrive.
Oh, shit.
I'm not joking.
Wow.
It's not me. Oh, but somebody has. Do you have it on hand? One year
this?
For Tom's birthday.
Oh, wait, this is Coke. I'm kidding.
No, 1 year for Tom's birthday, I found this. I didn't know this existed. So the giant green goblin head on the front of the truck in Maximum Overdrive. So they were doing repair. Somebody owns it and they were doing like kind of repairs and buffing on it.
Sure.
And they were like, well, I actually took all the shavings from it, right? That came off during the buffing that are like a piece of this truck piece. And I put them all in this vial. Someone's going to want to own it. And I agreed someone was going to want to own it. So I just bought it for him.
That's lovely. That's very sweet. I think that Stephen King, first of all, I agree with everything both of you are saying. As a person who is not a Stephen King aficionado, so from the outside looking in, I think that he has a, you know, I literally just watched Shawshank Redemption for my AFI movie club with friends the other night, and it's an unimpeachable masterpiece as far as I'm concerned. I have not read the source material, but I think that his stuff has the potential to be adapted into some of our greatest films, right? It's also adapted into some of our worst films, right? They're hard to make.
Because with him, it's about the voice. He's got a very distinctive voice, and this movie is trying to capture that voice. It wants to have that, like, you know, kind of main small town, whatever kind of feel to it that, you know, earlier movies got, you know, like a Christine or a Shawshank Redemption, or what movies later, Dr. Sleep, you know, Misery, all that stuff.
Yep.
But when you don't get the voice right, it's everything else just kind of falls apart, because narratively, you know, I don't think he's bad narratively, but, you know, the biggest knock against him has always been he doesn't know how to end a story. So that's always a problem when you're trying to adapt a thing.
Which, so they say, with him, it's how many times in the It movies, which I watched recently, my God, they say,
well, because, like, you literally cannot do the ending of the book unless you want to get put on a registry.
And not the national.
No,
not the national film registry. It's weird. That's why there's really, I mean, there's been good filmmakers, but there's only been three filmmakers that get Stephen King, that are like the Stephen King whisperers. Rob Reiner, Frank Darabont, and Mike Flanagan. Other people have come in and made good. Don't you give me that fucking look, young man.
I'm
talking to Phil.
Oh, I'm still over here laughing about the National Film Registry, Sex Offender Registry thing. Because I'm just picturing the inducted movies having to go house to house and just go, I'm 1990s house party. I have to let you know that I've moved into the Library of Congress.
Hello, just, I am the usual suspects.
That's not in yet.
I agree with you that it's a very specific thing. I do think that one of the mistakes that seems to be made too is they kind of, the adaptations can get too hung up on the mythology, which I don't think is King's strongest suit. So, like,
the
I think
bad
about,
ones get hung up on being too faithful.
Well, that even I would even problem. Just, I mean, even the Castle Rock TV shows, even 11/22/63, which I couldn't even finish. I mean, these are just like.
Well, Castle Rock's its own weird thing that could have been good, but they didn't even feel like King, because even King's craziest shit, like the Dark Tower books, are never that densely mythological and so much about the mystery box. And then 11/22, I mean, it could have been good if it wasn't for Franco. Honestly, I think Franco was the biggest problem of that movie.
Direction.
I never finished it because I just couldn't deal with Franco in the role. But
yeah, I mean,
I think the biggest problem that King adaptations face is the ones that work know how to change things. Shawshank is better than the novel, the short story, the novella, because Darabont makes smart changes. The Mist, maybe the biggest change of all time that everyone's like, this is better than the book. Dr. Sleep makes changes. Then you look at maybe the most egregious example of trying to be too faithful to the book, the Shining miniseries that he does a few years after this Mick Garris. Yeah. They, when you get too stuck on to the letter of the law with Stephen King's work, if you go beat for beat, it's not going to work. His stuff is so novelistic and so, you know, things that are okay in a book. You know, he does some weird shit. Sometimes it just doesn't translate to the screen.
I think that's the big thing, Tom, and I agree with you there, that, like, Stephen King's stuff works on the page, right? And not even just the big stuff, right? Like, a common complaint about King when you watch, like, his stuff, his movies, is, and I rewatched Sleepwalkers. Yes, I've watched it twice in a week because I hate myself. Because my significant other had never seen it, and we have a cat. And I was like, I promise you, you don't understand how cat heavy this movie is. Like, you are not prepared for who the hero of this film is.
Clovis, baby.
So we sat and watched it, right? and we're watching it, and it's like all of these early 90s teenagers listening to, like, 50s doo-wop, right? But I'm saying, like, listening to 50s doo-wop, And I'm like, and she goes, huh, weird. I'm like, you need to understand this is his thing. Like, yep. A fundamental issue with Stephen King is that he grew up in like the 50s, 60s. And no matter when the book is set, teenagers live and act like this. In a book, you can buy that, right? Like, yep. Christine, like, because the actual cognitive dissonance of seeing everybody dressed like the 80s or 90s listening to you don't have that. But when you're presented with it on screen, it feels like you're watching the 90s Brady Bunch movie, right? Where you're like, you don't, none of you teenagers care about this stuff.
You know, what's interesting about what you're saying, I agree with you 100%, is, you know, the mad dynamic component of this, my brain immediately goes to Twin Peaks, right?
Mm-hmm.
And David Lynch also does a very similar thing. But when David Lynch does it, it feels obviously sort of dreamlike, nightmarish, yeah. Kind of, you know, it's a tweaking of reality.
This is not doing that.
No, whereas with King, it's super grounded, and it's just like they just happen to really like this music. It doesn't make any sense.
It wants to have it both ways. It wants to be, I mean, because that's, again, that's the thing about The Voice. His stuff is so much about what if, like, the real world got, you know, blown up by some crazy thing. Like, okay, I'm a kid and my car is possessed, or, you know, oh, I'm a writer and I get kidnapped by a psychotic fan. You know, there's a clown in the sewer. Like, okay, like, it's all this shit of trying to really, like, he doesn't really do fantasy a lot other than the Dark Tower and this book The Eyes of the Dragon, which is kind of tied into
Fairy Tale, which I actually bought and I'm gonna read.
Fairy Tale, but Fairy Tale is kind of doing what I'm saying he does, because that's very much about the real world, and it's almost like an Alice in Wonderland, a Wizard of
Man
Oz.
Loves a portal. Loves a portal.
He loves a He loves a portal. He loves a door. You would think he's an exec at Marvel. I get it. But he doesn't really do the world is weird and here's a story set in a weird world. He does here's the real world. It's almost Lovecraftian in that sense, where it's you're about to see something that shouldn't be. And
well, I want to give a little bit of context for this film, because I do think that it fits into what you're talking about in the sense of it's not his strength. When newcomers, Charles, played by Brian Krause, and his mother, quote unquote, Mary, played by Alice Krieg, settle into town, the local residents do not suspect that they are shapeshifters looking to feed on the town's virgin girls. Charles quickly befriends innocent and chaste Tanya, played by Madge and Amick, when he begins attending high school, hoping to take her life force in order to feed his mother. When Tanya agrees to a first date with Charles, she may learn his true intentions the hard way. It's a very strange synopsis. Sleepwalkers opened on April 10th, 1992 against Basic Instinct, White Men Can't Jump, Beethoven, and Fern Gully. Just to give you a sense of the
breadth this of and 1992. Basic Instinct, that's a good double feature. That's a kinked out fucking double feature.
I would counter this in Beethoven's a good double feature, you know? Dog, people, like, cat, people, cats. All covered.
I wish Charles Grodin was in this movie. Charles Grodin as the sheriff having to deal with this
counterpoint,
bullshit.
Counterpoint, Grodin should just be their neighbor, and we just keep cutting back to him going, there's so many cats! Why are there so many cats?
Yeah.
Also, why are the cats unable... Why are the cats unable to get past the fucking traps on the lawn? Don't the cats know they can just walk around?
More importantly, I'm deeply concerned because, you know, our cat likes to sit by the window a lot. Right? And we thought that was safe because we were not aware until we watched this film that cats can punch through glass.
Which is fucking cool.
Which is
cats can punch through glass.
Completely unaware that cats
and cats can see if the people around you are weird incest cat people.
Yeah, which, I mean, I think I knew that before. But this film goes on to make $30 million on a $15 million budget. It has 29% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 31% from audiences. Variety called it an idiotic horror pop boiler.
Rude.
There's really, I honestly went through most of the Rotten Tomatoes, and there's really no reviewers of note that's worth kind of quoting.
There is no positive end to this movie. This is a it's midnight and we're drunk. Let's watch something really fucking silly. And
but this movie opens number one at the box office. And this speaks to both of your point about the Stephen King of it all, right? Like this movie was called Stephen King's Sleepwalkers, right? Like it was branded with him. It was a Sony movie. If I'm not mistaken, yes, it was a Columbia movie. You know, it came out in April. It really didn't have a ton of competition, even though Basic Instinct goes on to make $400 million at the box office. This movie really just kind of swoops in, makes some cash, and gets the fuck out. And as I sort of was doing what little research I did, because there wasn't a ton to be found online, there was a moment where they talked about a sequel where Tabitha, Stephen's wife, came up with an idea that somehow has to do with a women's basketball team of some sort.
Come on, that what a tease.
What if we get our hands on Tabitha King's screenplay for Sleepwalkers 2 and it is literally just Love and Basketball, word for word,
a cat person.
Yeah, precisely. Okay. Precisely.
And Clovis joins the basketball team because there ain't no rule that says a cat can't play basketball.
So,
Bellas, we've cracked it.
Can I just say, though, that when I hit play on this film and I'm watching the first, I want to say 15, 20 minutes of this movie, no shit, I started to think, like, is there a TV show in this? Like, is there a world where I go and take a general at Sony and say, like, guys, Sleepwalkers. But then by the end of the movie, I was like, I can't do it. I can't in good conscience go into anyone.
Phil, if I may, the fact that you watched 20 minutes of this and your brain went to, maybe I could take a general and pitch this as a TV show, indicates one thing, and that is you need to leave Los Angeles for a while.
Well,
this place has poisoned your brain.
Well, listen, he hasn't been able to write for a while. It only takes a swift breeze to get him hard, it's okay.
Phil, when they used to tell like poets in the 19th century, like, you need to go away to the beach for like a couple weeks to heal. You need to go away from Los Angeles.
Well, let me give a little bit of explanation.
I actually get where Phil's coming from, because it does have the feeling of it's adapted from a book that's a lot longer and they just started pulling pages out to make it a brisk 90 minutes. You're like, is there going to be more to this? Because I've rewatched it and like you just look through the Wikipedia description and you go, that's all that happens in this movie. It feels like they're setting up a lot and
But I'll say the other part of it too is, I mean, listen, this is not going to come as a surprise to either of you. IP is everything right now, right? So if you can find an obscure movie or an obscure thing and find a new spin on it or a new way into it, you might be able to do something with it. And I'm watching the first 20 minutes of this movie and I'm thinking, listen, it's a fucking Stephen King thing. Like, it's not crazy for me to be like, okay, you know, obviously these are cheesy effects and obviously this is, you know, this is a kind of a B movie, but like, is there enough here in terms of like, not even mythology, because there is very little. We see some sketches at the beginning that straight up made me fucking laugh in the credit sequence. Those cat people, like, illustrations are hilarious. But all this is
cats breastfeed human babies all the time.
That I was just like, listen, I could do the work to turn this to, you know what I mean, to turn this into something if it was worth doing. And by the end of the film, I was just like, I can't do it.
It's funny because King did pretty much redo this. It's Dr. Sleep. He just took all the weird cat shit out of it and just made energy vampires going after a young girl and Danny has to save her. It's the same thing. He's just like, oh, well, let's do this, but good.
I mean, I will say,
well, or just, you say energy, I say eating dead people's farts, but you know, whatever, that's cool.
Well, she wasn't dead, so she was purposely conscious while she was farting out of her mouth.
So, I mean, I guess my thing with that, I make the joke about you gotta leave LA, but I do think it's more the thing of like, I don't know, there's something about watching this in particular, right?
Yes, yes.
And I agree with you, Phil, when you're talking about like IP is everything. IP also kind of was everything in a way. Like, obviously,
yes, yes.
Obviously, you're not going to sit down and say, like, well, 1992 is the exact same cinematic landscape as now, right? but for the fact that, like, what I'm, you know, you've kind of really discovered, you know, doing this year in particular, right? Like, you had done 1989 previously, and you talked about, like, that's kind of where you're starting to see a lot of, like, things get stale and properties get stale. And you're in a period in 92 where, like, people want something new, right? And not just in the movies, right? They want something new everywhere. Like, this is the Clinton year, right? Like, this is, you know, we're a couple years away from Sonic the Hedgehog. Like, everybody wants an alternative. And I think that since there is no dominant force at this time, slapping Stephen King as an IP, like, slapping that on something is going to get people to show up because they want something to enjoy.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Like, I mean, a perfect example, it happened again this year, right? I mean, literally this year, last month, we had a horror movie mm-hmm. that opened huge because it was based on a popular IP and its fans showed up and had a good time because they're like, well, this is a thing I'm a fan of.
Yep.
But when you sit down, you're like, this is full of mythology that is incomprehensible. It keeps adding new plot elements where you go, I'm sorry, they're ghosts too. They're ghost people in I'm referring to, of course, Five Nights at Freddy's, but it is a similar thing of like, where people showed up because they're like, yeah, I know this property. And a lot of people, you know, I think we kind of, because you're talking about how much money this made, right? I think we maybe don't talk about enough when we talk about film and film analysis, how much wanting to like something factors in.
Absolutely.
Right? Absolutely, like, yeah. You can walk into a movie and like come away defending something vociferously because you went in going like, yeah. Look, it's Stephen King. I like Stephen King. Because to watch this now, it doesn't make sense that this made money. To watch this now, it doesn't make sense that anybody came out of this thing or even making this thing. We're like, yeah, I think people are going to get on board with the incest cat people. But people just kind of went, yeah, I guess I could. Like, you should know we're in trouble from the beginning because you start with a title card that's just like, all right, Sleepwalkers. Yeah, we all know Sleepwalkers. We're all familiar. We've all read this book that's made up, you know, this whatever it is.
It's also framed like it's framed like a dictionary definition.
Yes. Yeah. A dictionary definition. Sleepwalkers,
like,
you know.
Duh, this is what sleepwalkers are.
We're all familiar.
We all just know. I mean, listen, every day I'm fighting off fucking sleepwalkers and yeah. I'm just trying to go to the grocery store. It's like, leave me alone. I'm trying to get soda. Leave me alone.
That's where it starts with that title card. And like you sit back, like I sit back and see that. And then as the movie is like introducing new and more elements of like, the sleepwalker mythology, I'm like, is this a real piece of folklore that I am unaware of? Because you're not doing any, you're not having a character turn around at any point and be like, they're gonna turn invisible. No, it just happens, and I'm just supposed to go like, is this fucking yeah. part of what are the rules of these things? Like,
well, there is no Dick Halloran showing up to be like, here's The Shining, here's what's going on, like blah blah blah. It is just this weird. Just throwing you into the deep end of this gobbledygook that really just makes no sense. I mean, to the point where you go, well, all right, well, what are the rules? All right, well, I guess the only way they can get hurt is if a cat attacks them. But then this fucking dipshit just gets his eyes poked out at the end and he's dead now. And you're like, what is this? He's dead?
So what's interesting is this movie has sort of a cold open, if you will.
Weird cold open. Pretty dark.
With Mark Hamill, who's a sheriff. They find a drained young woman, it seems, with a rose.
First,
in
they
her
find
hair.
A bunch of massacred cats.
Yes, sorry, my apologies. Like, they find a ton of cat carcasses. But the only reason I want to bring up this opening, other than the fact that obviously we'll walk through the movie, but I just feel like I kind of understood the tone of the opening.
Mm-hmm.
It's arch for sure, as you said, Tom. Like it's silly. But I was like, okay, is this the wavelength it's existing? Are we kind of on a Sam Raimi-esque kind of, you know, horror comedy, what have you? But it then kind of vacillates to taking itself very seriously at times. It also, as you mentioned, Mike, it has an incest relationship as kind of the beating heart of this movie.
It's not even subtext. It's straight up just,
yeah, they're just straight up
mother.
Fucking, yeah.
Mother, let's go upstairs and yeah.
that,
go
can
to
I
the
just,
bone zone.
Can I just note, so I was watching it with my partner earlier and the two of them, like he's saying, you're so beautiful. They're dancing together. And the first thing she says at any point is she just goes, all right, so is this like, I can't tell before they kiss her. And she's like, I can't tell if that's his mom and they're a little too close or this is a Mrs. Robinson situation. Like, I can't really tell. And then they start kissing and she goes, oh, so it's a Mrs. Robinson situation then. And I went, no, no, it's what you thought at first.
But this is here's my question. Subcategory on Pornhub.
Yeah. Well, because it's weird because, and I'm not suggesting necessarily that I needed an answer to this, but whatever. There's kind of like two stages of, let's say, transformation, if you will, that I find a little confusing, which is there's them in human form. There's them in sort of cat people form.
Oh, we must discuss that.
And then there's a third stage, which is almost like a sweaty skinned bear situation of some sort.
Yeah. And also, let's not call them cat people. Obviously. Let's not call them cat people, because when he's in his like mid form transformation, he looks like fucking Christine Baranski in the Grinch movie. He looks like Christine. He looks like one of the Who's in Whoville. Like totally, when the mom turns, she looks a little like Buffy vampire-esque, but he looks like a fucking Ron Howard Who.
And that I is agree, a true 100%. Horror movie. That also, is the scariest movie.
But you know, you're talking about the prologue, Phil, the opening sequence. And I think the other element there that works so well, because I agree with you about feeling like, oh, this is a weird life I can get on. The opening scene is not giving you any answers, right?
Yeah,
it's like these cats have been murdered, right? Why?
It's mysterious.
Yeah, there's this young girl. Why? And if the whole movie is we got to figure out what the fuck's going on and you uncover the mythology as you go on, that movie is watchable. That movie is very watchable. And instead, what
we get answers.
We get it. Well, we don't even get all the answers, because what I love is we get the title card. Again, benefited from watching this with somebody else, because we get like the little dictionary description, all that crap. And then later, we see the high school from the outside, right? To skip ahead, we see the high school from the outside and we hear a voice going, they were sleepwalkers. They ran in the night. And before we cut inside, Bella, my significant other, turns and she goes, oh, this is that. So there's going to be like the teacher who's explaining the mythology. And I went, you would think. No, it's him.
Just,
it is
just straight
the
up telling
sleepwalker
us
who decided his class essay should be about sleepwalkers that he's reading to everyone. And what's interesting is the teacher is going, there's something off about this. And that's when you go, oh, he's like a Giles in Buffy, like he's hip to mythology. No, he's listening to him read an essay on sleepwalkers and going, I'm going to try and grab his penis.
It's not just just anybody. It's Otho.
It
will
is
always be
and the mayor from Nightmare Before Christmas. Yes.
And the mayor, of course.
But you're also forgetting an important element is that when he gives his little short, you know, creative fiction presentation to the class, it makes Madchen Amick so fucking wet. She's like, I need to immediately throw away my innocence for this man.
So, okay. I need to talk about Madchen Amick for a second, because I had an enormous...
I gotta give her credit. I think she knows what movie she's in.
She does.
I think
she
knows exactly
what
movie
part of that is because she has some Twin Peaks.
Lynch. Yeah, she's got Lynch, yeah.
So she's able to kind of be like, okay, I think I can get on this wavelength. I watched Twin Peaks when I was a kid, loved it, had an enormous crush on Madchen Amick in Twin Peaks. I still do. She's still like stunning. I think she's a great actor who just didn't really get a ton to do. Hollywood just didn't really give her a whole lot of opportunities, unfortunately. And I agree with you, Tom, that I do think she understands what movie she's in. She's doing kind of the best she can. And when the film just, in my opinion, just goes careening off the rails in the third act, I think it almost works for like the first 40 or so minutes. We will get to the various things that don't work, but I do think that the introduction to her character at the Aero Theater, which is a great theater in Los Angeles in Santa Monica, her dancing, and she's just like, it's just Twin Peaks, really. Like, it's just her dancing and there's music and she's just awesome and it just works. Is his name Brian Krause? Is that his name?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is fucking terrible. And
Charlie Brady. a beacon of sex appeal.
I feel a little bad because I do think that he's being directed in such a way to seem kind of, again, I don't mean to keep hitting the Twin Peaks thing, but I do really think that that is a big influence here.
Well, it's so big. It's such a big, obvious thing.
I feel like it's being directed like Peyton plays, right? Which was the thing that Lynch was inspired by to do Twin Peaks, which is that sort of everyone's a little bit dialed up. There's kind of this, like, you know, big saucer eyes kind of component to Brian Krause. And he's, you know, he's got kind of this like aw shucks kind of thing that's like B movie kind of performance. But him and Madchen are just not on the same wavelength. So they're just not matching. And the scenes with his mom are just deeply uncomfortable and weird. And it's very strange. But I do think that Madchen is really good in this, as good as you could expect someone to be in this movie.
I think she knows exactly what movie she's in. I think Krause is probably the thing that really does throw all of this off kilter in a big way. Cause I think Alice Krieg knows what movie she's in.
Yes, she does.
In a small part, but I do think Ron Perlman knows what movie he's in. He just shows up for a bit and he knows exactly what bullshit he's supposed to do. But some of the others don't, like the sheriff and whatever, but like, and the guy who owns Clovis, the real MVP of the movie, Clovis.
Yeah, absolutely.
A movie that very boldly says all cops are bastards except for Clovis.
Also, is this just a movie about how Stephen King hates cats?
It loves cats, but it also goes through a lot of fucking cat corpses to get to the ultimate point.
But you know what the weird thing is? And this needs to be addressed because I noticed this on the rewatch, right? Mm. If you cut out the prologue, right?
Yeah.
If you cut out the prologue, this movie doesn't really want to show you dead cats, right? This movie has one cat get its spine snapped, but otherwise, like, you hear the cat caught in the trap.
That's a crazy
but I'm saying,
moment.
Like, but I'm
that
saying,
shit made me laugh. She just grabs the cat, just snap, and I'm just like, oh, what the
but
fuck?
So, but that thing, you hear the cat, you'll hear like a cat get caught in a trap and yowl or something like that.
Ow!
But right. So you would think that this movie tricks you into thinking like, oh, they don't want to show the cats dying, right? Because that might upset the audience, which makes a lot more sense if you hadn't shown me at the start 30 fucking cats like hung from their neck, some of which are missing the bottom half of their bodies.
You can't have a cat looking
like Drew Barrymore getting hung in Scream and then later be like, but let's not show a cat in a bear trap.
I just want to imagine what the day of shooting was like for Alice Krieg, where they're just like, all right, Alice, we're going to throw a toy cat at you, and you're just going to have to snap it in half like a chicken wing, and then toss it.
I would argue, though, not the funniest thing to happen to a cat in this movie. Because the funniest is when there's a cat grabbing the mom when she's in full, like, beast mode.
Yes.
And then the sheriff shoots her with a shotgun, and the cat on her back... flying like when they used to throw Gonzo on the Muppet Show.
When it lands on its feet.
This movie fucking rules. Come on. This is the coolest shit in the world. This is
Can I also just say, though, this movie has several shots of just a bunch of cats on a front lawn.
Yes.
And it is, they're so passive.
It's trying
they don't
to do
seem
the
even
thing.
Remotely threatening. That you it's every try- time I would just laugh and you'd be like, guys, it's just a bunch of cats just sitting on a front lawn.
It's like, oh, we need to lay out fucking bear traps for the cats. They're not moving. Get a gun and shoot them.
But also,
you
like
fucking imbeciles.
When all the cats are coming to the rescue and they have to speed up the footage because they realize cats doing a little trot has no energy whatsoever.
None.
Right? Like, there's nothing. It doesn't.
How funny was it when the sheriff's just outside and he just goes, Clovis? And Clovis just scales the house, breaks in, and just, you're just like,
can I just
say, Clovis, let's just fucking do it.
When
hell yeah.
Clovis fucking mauls the shit out of, what's it, Charles? I think it's his name.
Charlie Brady.
Charles. It's incredible. Because, first of all, it's. it's not scary because it's a cat, right? So like it's just not that big.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it is being like crazy vicious. And the way it's shot is pretty like violent and nuts. But I mean,
one of the best things about this movie is we get multiple sequences of a human adult actor having to pretend they're being attacked by a fake cat prop. It is so every time it is so funny. And they last a long time. They're not quick bits where it's like, oh no, the cat, and we gotta throw it. It's like a 5-minute sequence. No, fuck, this cat, fuck, shit, oh no.
Let's acknowledge one of the fundamental flaws of this movie. Every single thing goes on too long.
Well, yeah.
Stephen King has a cameo.
Not long enough.
Stephen King has a cameo where he's talking to like a technician or whatever.
He goes to Toby Hooper.
That's the thing. So he's talking to Toby Hooper. And he's doing his, golly gosh, what are you doing? And I'm like, this is a funny cameo. And then they're like, he needs to walk to a second person. He needs to walk to Clive Barker and go, oh golly, what's going on? And then walk to a third person. You're like, this
tells him to shut the fuck up.
It's like, guys,
it's a great scene, though.
We have extended this bit too long. We have a cameo is one thing, right?
That's what this has moved beyond a
cameo. To like supporting
Joe Dante's also in this, and John
Landis are in the morgue scene.
Yeah,
it is. See, it's shit like that that makes me so fucking. It blows my mind that this wasn't Cokie or a King, because this has big Maximum Overdrive energy of just the bit is done, buddy. Move on to the next thing. We get it. You feel like a Superman and nothing can stop you, but edit the fucking picture, please.
This isn't even a long movie, though, guys. This movie's like 88 minutes. So, like, on some level, they're padding it out. I mean, I will say that Stephen King, who is almost like, it's scary how much he looks like Joe Hill. Like, it's scary how much Joe Hill just looks like a younger version of Stephen King.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty nuts. But, like, that scene, admittedly, goes on for way too long. But also, you've got a car chase in the middle of this movie that also goes on for quite some time. It has an incredible moment where Clovis just looks straight down the barrel of the lens of the camera, which I absolutely love.
All for it.
It's almost disingenuous to call it a car chase because it's almost shot like something from like a 1950s cop show or something where it's just
100. Like, it looks like something out of The Naked Gun.
Yeah, The Naked Gun, exactly. It feels like something out of The Naked Gun. And then when he pulls up to the cop car and Clovis just looks at him and he just goes, oh, what the fuck? There's a cop. Oh, fuck. Oh! And he just fucking skids the fuck out. And you're just like, guys,
Tom, you're missing the best line in this movie.
Okay,
to cut you off, Mike.
No, I was going to bring up the same thing you were going to bring up.
So. Stop looking at me, you fucking cat.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. Yeah. Guys, this is what the movies were made for.
I'm not joking when I say he delivers that with the exact same cadence as Billy Madison says, stop looking at me, you swan. And let me be 100%
clear. I wonder if Adam Sandler saw this movie.
It's entirely possible. Let me be 100% clear so everyone knows. Yes, when that line came up in the movie, she and I both looked directly at the cat and decided we have to say this line to the cat, who looked at us with the same look of app. Like, there is this thing of, like, we thought maybe she'll want to watch it because sometimes she likes seeing other animals on screen. Oh, the cat looked at the screen for, like, 5 seconds, looked back at us, and maybe we're projecting, but the face seemed to indicate you can do better than this. You can use your time. I don't have thumbs. I can't operate the remote. You can turn this off at any time, and you're choosing not to.
So it needs to be said that I'm on a strange sort of like cat run right now that I didn't really know I was going to be on, which is watched this movie.
Are you chasing some pussy?
Excuse me?
Are you chasing some pussy, Phil?
No. This movie, I went to see The Marvels, which has a lot of cats in it.
Mm-hmm. A lot of cats.
I actually like The Marvels, by the way. Go see The Marvels. It's being unfair. You didn't like The Marvels?
Fucking terrible.
Phil,
come on,
Phil,
man.
Phil.
Come on.
Phil, Tom has come out of virtually every Marvel project the last 3 years with the tone of, I was on board up until this one. This is the one that lost me for three years straight. He did not like The Marvels.
So here's, I don't want to get into a whole Marvel
I haven't seen it yet. But
I'll just say this. I also have Marvel exhaustion. I've basically stopped watching any of the television output. I haven't seen Ant-Man 3. I think that basically everything since the pandemic has been diminishing returns for sure. This movie, to me, sort of got pulled a shitty straw. It's been punted several times. It's been edited. It just feels as though Marvel, for whatever reason, has decided to like turn this movie into a punching bag. I think that it's, and I don't want to suggest that it is because it's written and directed by women and stars two diverse women. I don't think that is the case. But I think that there is this very toxic awfulness that's going on around this film online that I think is also motivating people to not go and see what I think is a pretty fun, breezy 90-minute like, Marvel movie.
There's two reasons why people aren't going to see this movie. It's not the online shit. That shit doesn't matter. We've learned that lesson from The Last Jedi. That has a negligible impact on box office. There's two reasons why Marvel's is not doing good. One, people are fed up with Marvel. They're just fed up. They're not getting the same quality they used to. We're done. It's over. I love this shit, and I'm getting sick and tired of it. And two, everyone forgets. Nobody liked Captain Marvel. It made $1 billion, but nobody liked it.
It made almost $2 billion.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. Everyone was hyped up. Okay, it's Marvel's first female-led superhero movie. Brie Larson's an Oscar winner. This should be fun. Marvel's on a good run. And then it came out, and everyone just was like, that was it.
Well, okay. I don't want to turn this into a whole giant thing, but I'll just say that, and obviously I'll let you speak, Mike, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I'll just say that you're not wrong, Mike, that Captain Marvel did as well as it did for those reasons, right? People wanted to see a first female hero. Brie Larson won an Oscar, what have you. They also do like Brie Larson as Captain Marvel. She has shown up in a bunch of things. She is a character that people like. So I don't think it's fair on that front. I think that the strikes hurt this movie. They couldn't promote this film. It's been pushed its release date several times. It feels like some weird redheaded stepchild. I think that audiences are sensing that. And then I think on top of everything else, I really do think that, you know, you said that people are done with Marvel. I don't think people are done with Marvel. I mean, Guardians 3 made a boatload of money. It didn't do as well as the previous ones, but it still made a shit ton of money. People aren't done with Marvel. They just want the movies to be good. And they have decided preemptively that this isn't a good one.
Well, that's,
and I think that that's not based on anything real.
That's the main thing I was going to say is like a lot of this Marvel discourse is you know, it's like I said earlier, where we don't factor in enough, like, how much we decide ahead of time whether we want to like something or not allows us to give somebody a benefit of the doubt. I think that when you talk to people, like a lot of people who are like, you know, film people I'm talking about, right? Like film people who have been saying that Marvel's killing cinema for like well over a decade now.
Yeah.
You talk to them about this recent batch of movies and they'll tell you like, well, there were two that were good. The one that Sam Raimi, who I liked, did, and the one that James Gunn, who I liked, did. I think the other element, though, to disagree with Tom a little bit, you know, the online-ness of it, I think matters to some degree because there are some people who, to make their point about condemning these movies and saying, oh, you know, Marvel bad killing cinema, are intentionally or not playing into those bad actors. Because, like, that Variety piece that came out recently, right, that was all about this stuff, everybody read it, and I saw everybody who for 10 years had been telling me these movies are killing cinema retweeting it and going like, fuck yeah, this is bad. And then people started coming out afterward and going like, it's weird how they throw Nia DaCosta under the bus, because what actually happened is the movie got pushed back. That's the only reason she was starting another movie. And also a guy came out and went, I've been attached to Blade for a long time. They're replacing Blade with a Lady Blade script. I have no idea that this happened. And you hear those things and you're like, guys, you didn't need to include this in the report. And those kind of things only exist to inflame the kind of guys who are going to have crazy YouTube thumbnails. Now, Marvel and the Marvel movies do have problems, right? And you can just talk about those problems. And I think the issue is you have a lot of people who, there's a lot of things going into why a movie like this is getting the flack that it is, right? And some deservedly so, and others not so much, right? What I think is not necessarily great about, and we saw this happen with Star Wars, and we saw this happen with other franchises, which is it's not great to turn around necessarily and go, well, there's no such thing as bad actors in this, or there's no such thing as like nefarious sociological elements to this, because those don't matter. Those don't count. What the, you know, the weird trolls online, the weird, you know, crazy people, they don't matter. It's actually that this thing is objectively bad and destroying cinema, because we're allowing leeway where now we look at, you know, like that Star Wars or any of those, and you're like, oh no, there are some people who are just like shitty racist people.
Yeah, I mean, there are shitty racist people. I'm not saying that there are, but it has no actual impact on the fucking product, because
I don't agree.
The Rise of Skywalker made less than The Last Jedi, and everybody hated The Last Jedi. Like, no, they tried to make a movie towards fucking the racist trolls that they thought actually mattered, and it didn't fucking matter.
I'm not saying that playing to them increases the box office, but I am saying, like, it's you know, there is a particular narrative that folks get attached to, and they will stand by that narrative no matter what. And I think that when we are talking about film, particularly the modern film landscape, we have allowed ourselves to, if we want to believe that, again, these movies are killing cinema or these movies are bad or whatever like that, like, again, it's, we are watching people go to bat for things and points of view. You and I both know people who were like, who really bought into that, oh, there's a Lady Blade script and they're trying to emasculate Blade, and we're retweeting that into infinity and making their comments on it. And then it was like, nobody ever said that.
I'm not talking about film Twitter. We tend to get, when we talk about shit like this, what the dickheads on film Twitter have to say. I don't give a fuck what they have to say.
Yeah, but we do. People, and that's why we're talking about it.
Because film Twitter is not actually affecting the box office of the movie, because if it did, Five Nights at Freddy's would have bombed, and it didn't, because regular ass people want to see it. Regular ass people aren't going to see the Marvels because they're sick of this shit. Someone at work thought the Marvels was a TV show, and you, Mike, did not know it came out this weekend.
I agree. Look, I'm saying there's a number of problems. I'm not suggesting otherwise.
So, like, let me just say this, because I really do see where you're both coming from, and I'm not.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The third movie that I was going to say, it actually does tie into this. The third movie that we're covering relatively soon is Batman Returns, which has a lot of cats in it as well. Spoiler. Catwoman. I bring this up because in 1992, Batman Returns comes out, you know, prior to all of the comic book scenario that we're in now, the shit ton of comic book movies that come out, right? Mm-hmm. And that movie comes out and it is pretty much resoundingly hated by critics. Mm-hmm. Parental associations say it's way too dark and fucked up for kids. Kind of agree, but that's neither here nor there. That's what I love about the movie. But I love it. I fucking love that it's, you know, people in skin tight leather beating the shit out of each other and a penguin man barfing up bile all day long. It's great. Great time at the movies, I think. But I bring this up just because I think that we to Tom's point, I think we've gone too far, right? With a lot of these, specifically with Marvel. I think DC has its own problems. I think that these comic movies have just are it flooded the market. I think that quality needs to triumph over quantity. I think that next year there's only one Marvel movie coming out if they're lucky, and it's going to be Deadpool 3, which I mean, who knows how that's going to be, but whatever. I think that this pause right now that Marvel's being forced into against their will is probably a good thing. It's probably an opportunity for them to sort of take stock of what's going on. They're probably going to lose their villain, it seems, in the end of this.
I think they were going to do this shit anyway. I think once Iger came back, he knew, like, he came out and said when he got rehired, like, we're putting out too much Marvel and Star Wars stuff. We got to stop. Let's
we don't have any Star Wars stuff out, but that's yeah. I understand what he's.
No, but he said, like, we flooded the market. We got too much shit because Chapek wanted to make Disney Plus a thing, and Disney Plus is bleeding fucking subscribers, and nobody watches these goddamn things.
No, for sure. The TV shows aside, all this is to say.
I know what you mean. I was just saying. I think the pause was coming anyway, but I know that might be true.
All this is to say that when you put it, if you put it next to 92, and you put it next to a year where. You know, you had a couple comic book things, if you're lucky. It was just a very different landscape. And I think that today there's just a lot of things bumping around in our heads when we're thinking about what we're going to watch, when we're going to watch them. And I think that it does have effects on a whole bunch of things. It affects the types of movies that are made. It affects the way that they're marketed. It affects the types of publicity that these things get. And I think it's I think that it's kind of a problem when this movie in particular, it's just it is not a fucking coincidence. It's just not a coincidence movie is getting the shit kicked out of it because it happens to be about women, that happens to be written and directed by women, that it happens to have diverse women in it. Like it's not a coincidence. It's just not.
I think it is. That's all I'm saying. Yeah, we saw it with Quantumania earlier this year. Quantumania got its ass kicked. Sure.
I think it's inarguable that, I mean, I agree with Phil only insofar as, like, I think it's inarguable to say, like, it's definitely a factor in some of the yelling, because whether or not you want to include in your Venn diagram those weird online people, the fact of the matter is, like, if you have a movie that is getting its ass kicked and getting yelled at by film critics and people who have legitimate concerns and are angry, it's like Captain Marvel 1, because you and I talked about this, Tom, when Captain Marvel 1 came out, which is now everybody can sit down with that first Captain Marvel movie and say whether or not you like it, there's flaws. There's a lot of flaws. Yeah. But when it first came out, like you and I talked about this while we were working at a movie theater, like it is tough. It was tough at that time to talk about that movie, because if you went, yeah, that movie bothers me, you would have to go with the caveat that I'm not like these other guys who are out here saying this movie's bad because Captain Marvel used to be a guy and isn't anymore. There is a need to separate oneself, because when these movies get that way and there is that heat on it, you know, it is, you have to separate yourself from those people. The fact of the matter is, yeah, the other movies, Marvel movies, have been taking a licking. There is no argument there, especially Ant-Man 3. However, when there is a large group of people yelling, because they are critics and because there are people who love cinema and because there are people who have legitimate gripes. And then the next time it's time to yell, they are also joined by alt-right Nazi people. It does get louder, because now those people have joined in the yelling, and it doesn't mean that the other people's grievances aren't real. It doesn't mean that at all. But it does mean that there is an extra element of anger at that. And I think that what weirds me out about the entire Marvel is killing cinema thing, and has for a while, is that people got so caught up in that idea. Marvel's killing cinema. It happened for a decade. And we watched, like, all of these people who had so whipped themselves up into a frenzy for that they were clinging to just about anything else, and they had picked their things. You and I have talked about this. I've talked about this plenty of times, that, like, you know, a lot of people, yes, it's the film Twitter people who were not supposed to count, but the film Twitter people who basically had decided Mission Impossible was the one good movie franchise for whatever arbitrary reason. And then this year, but no, because the only reason I bring that up is, like, I don't give a shit the Kitteridge is back.
What's going on?
Phil, you didn't know Kitteridge is back? We all know who Kitteridge is, and Kitteridge is back.
And he's great.
He's back, and America cares. But my thing is, like, that was a perfect example of, like, for so many years, the only alternative to Marvel... Mm-hmm. People were like, well, it's Mission Impossible, because that's at least made by an auteur and this and that, right? Mm-hmm. And then this year, it was just very fun to kind of see, like, Dead Reckoning Part 1 did not do well. And people were like, oh, man, this audience is bad. But then actual original movies did perform well at the box office, right? And it was this thing of like, I kind of felt like when I saw people going like, oh man, I don't know about audiences today, man. They don't want to see Dead Reckoning. Maybe they don't want great cinema. I'm like, they're going to see the 3-hour atomic bomb movie instead. Won.
I fully agree with you. I mean, listen, we could get into a whole thing here in terms of why some things performed and some things didn't. I think that Mission Impossible was poorly released. I think that it had a very, very narrow corridor with which to perform, which I don't think
they
did
also
well.
They realized too late that you shouldn't have called the movie Part One, because nobody wanted to see a Part One of a not complete story.
There is that. I mean, I think that, and I would also just, I didn't love Dead Reckoning. I thought it was fine. It's not one of my favorites in the franchise, but I just think that they really gave it a very, very narrow way to survive in that landscape. Like, you giving that movie 1 week before fucking Barbenheimer is a bad idea.
I mean, in fairness, though, imagine sitting somebody down again after, I'm only saying this, Maverick blew up the box office, sitting somebody down and going, I'm not sure if Tom Cruise can hold up to Cillian Murphy building an atom bomb and talking about communism for 3 hours. Somebody would have turned around to you and went, buddy, I think we're going to be okay.
Well,
so,
okay.
I don't disagree
with you, but I'm to play devil's advocate just for a quick second here. I do think that, you know, one of the things, and again, I think that Mission Impossible didn't perform for a myriad of reasons. I think the movie, A, wasn't as good as the previous installments. B, it didn't have a lot of time. But also, you know, smartly, Universal snagged all the IMAX screens for Oppenheimer, which is how a movie like that gets to $1 billion, is by, you know, doubling your ticket prices and making sure that people, and again, this is not to take away from his performance. I think it did very well for, because it's a good movie, but I do think that we're not really talking about that. One of the reasons that, you know, Maverick did as well as it did was it owned IMAX for like 6 months, basically. So like, part of its box office dollars comes from inflated prices that you get from IMAX. So when you take that out of the equation, which, if I'm being honest, I saw Dead Reckoning in IMAX and it wasn't shot in IMAX, so it didn't need to be seen in IMAX. And then you're just like, why did, and it doesn't matter. Point is, I think that Dead Reckoning underperforming is a testament to everything going wrong, right? Like, it just all stacked up against
it. But I also think there's one element of Dead Reckoning not doing well that is also why the Marvels isn't doing well.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, and this is something Tom and I've talked about, I think, a great deal, which is like, yeah, calling it Dead Reckoning Part One, right? And relying in some cases in the marketing on like, no, this is a much more character-driven film than the others, is the same problem that the Marvels, part of the reason it's underperforming is up until like 2 weeks ago, they were leaning really heavy into, so here are all of the TV shows you need to watch before you can see this movie, and here's all the stuff you need to watch. And then only in the last 2 weeks have they been like, no, you can go in fresh to this thing. And I think the problem is, especially the Mission Impossible movies, right? I think in the film Twitter bubble, where these are the only good franchise, everybody knows every character, right? You'll hear people like, and again, people I respect and love, who will be like, my God, like, I'm so into Benji. Meanwhile, the average person who goes to see that movie goes, I think I know Tom Cruise's name is Ethan. That's Simon Pegg. Like, most people go because it's like, I want to see really good action and cool stunts. Nobody, you know, the average person buying a ticket is not showing up like, well, I'm really invested in the saga of Ethan Hunt. It's like, oh, cool, another one of these that's going to be fun. Once you put in like Part One, right, it does seem to indicate like, no, trust me, you guys need to be real caught up on this mythology. And this was a year of people going, I want to go to the movies to watch one movie.
Well, you're speaking of something that I think is, and I've had this discussion with, you know, many friends during the strike and post strike, and this is a symptom of a bigger problem when it comes to movies and television, which is that weirdly you're now seeing, and I think we're getting away from this in movies, to your point, which is that it actually, like, a cinematic universe actually doesn't work very well. People don't like going to see things that then are then a fucking ellipse to another thing that they have to see. They want to go see a complete story. They want something that feels like its own thing. And I think that that's one of the things that I think Marvel is definitely pushing uphill right now, which is, we don't want to go see a movie that we won't completely understand unless we've seen two other television shows. Like, it's just not, this is not the movie going experience.
And that's, and That's why the only Marvel success story this year was Guardians 3. Yep. You didn't have to do homework. It Correct. Was just the third Guardians movie, Correct. Not the 24th Marvel yeah. movie.
It's why I have a good feeling to some degree or another to see what James Gunn does with DC to try to.
Well, if they release his movies up. And yeah, not get a tax write-off. I said this when I came out of the movie when I saw Mission Impossible with my brother. Chris, we talked about this on the Top Gun episode where I laid out my theories that it wasn't going to do as well as everyone thought it was. Yeah. I came out of that movie and I said to my brother, and we both liked it, but I said, this is like 3 hours long and it's more of a spy movie than an action movie. I don't think this is going to connect to a basic audience. It's a lot more about setup and like espionage and figuring it other than like the train thing at the end. It's kind of action.
There's a solid car chase scene in the center of it. But to your point, in comparison to Fallout, which I would argue is definitely one of the best in the franchise, which precedes it, I was surprised to your point about the smallness of it. I think, and again, this is just speculation. I don't have anything to solidify this theory, but I think COVID had a pretty significant effect on this movie.
I think that
there was a lot of stuff. The movie felt smaller. It to your point, felt very kind of intimate to some degree. The set pieces had a lot of green screen going on that, generally speaking, isn't really what the franchise is known for. So there was a lot of like, and they made such a stink out of the fucking motorcycle going off the cliff thing. And I was just like, okay, I mean,
it's five seconds. It's like not even impressive in the movie.
It's not that impressive in comparison to like the set pieces in Fallout are fucking crazy. Like you're watching that whole helicopter sequence.
Because the funny thing in Fallout is that in Fallout, they were preaching about him jumping out of the airplane and you go, sure. Wow, that's crazy. And it's the beginning of the movie. And then you get to the end. You're like, wait, he's flying a fucking helicopter now. Right, they didn't tell me about this shit.
Right. And the bathroom fight, which is one of the best hand-to-hand fights,
that movie's basically like every 5 minutes, here's a new set piece.
Right.
Oh,
right.
Set piece is over, 5 minutes to breathe, yeah. Here's another set piece. Yeah. Where I said to my brother, I'm like, this is more of a spy movie. There's a lot of complicated AI.
It's a lot of talk.
You know, yeah. who's on this side and what's the AI going to do? And S.A. Morales is talking about, I know exactly what's going to happen because I have AI. And just like, all right, can someone punch another man in the face right now, please?
But to get back to Sleepwalkers.
Thank God, yes.
I want to see how this trend. No, I want to see how this transition goes.
I have no transition. We're just going to start talking about Sleepwalkers now because we've had enough.
You had a smooth transition.
I tried the smooth transition earlier with Batman Returns to get us back to 92, and then you guys just pulled us right back towards 2023, which is fine. But
look,
we have not talked in months.
We've got a lot of spitting going down.
I get it. It's totally fair. I do want to talk for a second. We're in this car chase at this point in the movie, for reasons that just because I guess Stephen King needed them to, they can become invisible. They can just become invisible. Yeah. If they think, I don't know why. So his car just becomes invisible. He becomes invisible.
But then
invisible.
Clovis sees him.
But Clovis sees him, and that's when he says, stop looking at me, you fucking cat. And then Charles changes his car into a completely different car.
Yeah, sure.
Again, these are just like, these are superpowers. I'm just like, where are these coming from? And then you have Charles and Mary having sex. And then you see in the reflection of the mirror, the third phase of what they look like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you can't really make it out. You don't even really know what you're looking at.
It's just a skin lump
flaps.
Of clay.
Yeah. Just skin flaps.
It's just a lump of clay.
Can I just say one thing? Can I just say one thing that does tie this all together, truthfully?
Yeah.
The rug.
Thinking about it in this context, Sleepwalkers does feel like a movie that you were supposed to have read three books and watched TV.
That's what they said before.
You understand.
It feels like they're tearing every other page out to get everything in.
Yeah, it does feel like people would be next to me going, well, if you watched the HBO Max series Sleepwalkers, you would understand why they have that third form. Well, if you had watched the previous film, if you had watched Duma Key Dead Reckoning Part 1, you would understand why they're able to turn the car invisible. Mm. And
do you know that scene is... part of the reason why they had an NC-17 rating and they had to edit that scene down because Brian Krause was thrusting them hips and they were like, we do not like
92,
this.
Baby.
How could you tell from within that rubber suit?
Well, no, they cut it out. They cut it out.
Yeah.
It was McGarrett's like, oh, it's a it was a one take, and we were kind of like, fuck, how do we cut out the thrusting? It's like, oh, thank God we have a shot from the top to make these two lumps of shit look even
so
worse.
I want to just rewind for just a quick second about the tone of this movie, because I really do feel
there is
like
no tone.
The camp factor of this film,
yeah.
At times, it's wrapping its arms around it, right? You've got a man who gets stabbed with a corn cob, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
Which I don't really think you could break the skin with a corn cob, but that's neither here nor there.
I'll let you know.
Cool. but like that happens, and you're just sort of like, I mean, how seriously am I supposed to be taking this movie? And then you have like this crazy climax where you've got like people set on fire and it's quite upsetting.
When she picks up the sheriff like a fucking WWE wrestler and just impales his ass on the fence, I was just like, this is awesome. But it's also like this is like the seventh tone change in this scene.
And it's wild because to bring up Five Nights at Freddy's again, if I may.
Sure.
I apologize. But I was texting Tom about, have you seen Five Nights at Freddy's yet, Phil? Okay.
Good. Don't save your sanity.
No. I want you to watch it on Peacock.
I'll watch it.
So I want to hear, Tom, you have to agree. Much like our text chain after I saw it, Phil, I need you to just put us in a group text as you work through
sure.
the mythology of this thing, because it makes a lot of choices. But in this movie, there is one guy that Tom and I agreed like gets the tone of the movie, right? Okay. It's Gary the lawyer, right, Tom? Is it Gary? I don't remember his name.
Yeah, I don't know. The weird fucking lawyer guy.
Yeah, there's a guy who's like, he's a strange character actor guy, right? Uh-huh. And he exactly gets this right. The only two people I think who get the tone of that movie are Gary the lawyer, but also Matthew Lillard, right?
Mm, okay.
And it's worth noting that because when you're talking about tone, right, and oscillating between like when is this silly, when is it fun,
yeah,
Lillard has always been a fucking pro at that. Before I saw Freddy's, my partner and I watched Scream because she'd never seen it.
Great movie.
That is a movie.
Live her alone,
it
man.
Some, alone. Yeah, it has some very, but it has some very silly shit,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
It has, you know, Jamie Kennedy on the couch going, "Watch out, Jamie!" All that. A lot of Lillard's performance mm-hmm. treads that line, and I think totally. It's one of those things of like when you're talking about like, well, sometimes this movie is very silly and campy and other times it's very scary and mm-hmm. it doesn't know what it wants to be. Looking at what somebody like Lillard can do either in Scream or, and Tom, back me up on this, even in Freddy's, like Lillard knows how to calibrate that performance, right?
Yeah,
he's like the only one, but he's the one that gets like, listen, I'm not going to spoil anything about it, but like he is one where he's like, I get what this is, and I know how to make it like,
okay.
how to make it just silly enough, mm-hmm. like that, because Scream does it too. It knows how to be just silly enough that you, as a teenager in the audience, go, I'm going to laugh a little too loud at this, so that nobody knows it actually scares me a bit. That's the tone that this movie could. If it was,
I agree, because this
should be hitting.
I think it starts with that tone to some degree, right? When you when you have that cold open with Mark Hamill, who's hamming it up, like he does, generally speaking, know what movies he's in and television shows he's in.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of like, oh, okay, I think I understand where we are, but we truly outside of Madgen. I don't feel
there's
like
no
anyone
center
else
to
really
this
knows
movie.
Yeah.
Well, because there's no center to this movie. It's like you said, you think you're going to go in and there's going to be a mystery of like, okay, well, what's going on? We started with this dead girl in the opening. Yeah. We're in this new town. What's going on? But then it's like, okay, well, here's these two weird cat people. They're fucking in the attic. Okay, great. Madchen Amick is here because, you know, she's a virgin, so we're going to eat her soul, whatever. Okay, great. But like, what's the arc of anything in this movie? Like, no, we're not focusing on her, like, dealing with being a girl in high school, and she's dealing with boys, and there's this one guy, oh, I like him, and he's a fucking freak, it turns out. There's no arc with these two fucking vampire dipshits, because it's just like, we're hungry, let's go eat some virgins. It's like, all right, you got anything else for us?
There's one other thing that I wanted to mention, too, which, you know, and listen, this is a production thing, and I'm sure there were reasons for it, but, like, way too much of this movie takes place during the day. This entire movie should take place at night. All this stuff during the day, I mean, we had this issue on Sleepy Hollow when we were making that, which is that, like, listen, night shoots suck. No one likes it. It fucking blows. It's hard to shoot. It's a pain in the ass. Everything looks better at night. And especially when you're dealing with anything in the horror genre or supernatural space, it's just like, I'm just watching a guy chase another guy through the woods in the middle of the day. It just doesn't have the power that it could if it was shot at night. And I think that's a big problem with this movie. I know that it seems maybe overly simplistic, but I just really think that it just takes the tone of this movie, whether or not it's supposed to be tongue in cheek, which I think a lot of the time it is. I just think that atmospherically, you just want that. And the movie's called fucking Sleepwalkers.
Yeah. Phil, it's funny you mentioned Sleepy Hollow. I mean, of course, you know, again, that's, you're coming from your own experience, sure, with your version of that. But, like, I'm just thinking about the fact that, you know, because my partner actually up in the real Sleepy Hollow this year, seeing Irving's house and all. And when you go to upstate New York, they're doing a ton of like Washington Irving Sleepy Hollow-y stuff, sure, you know. But in any event, one time, it was a different time, I think it was up in like Kinderhook, New York, somewhere else upstate New York, and it was around Halloween time, and they brought out a Headless Horseman, right?
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you're in Disneyland on Halloween, they bring out their Headless Horseman.
Mm-hmm.
The key difference here, if you go to Disneyland, they know you have to bring the Headless Horseman out at night. Because if Ichabod Crane's walking with a lantern and the Headless Horseman comes out, yeah, it is legitimately so upsetting we watch children cry, sure, on Main Street. It was incredible. Or on Buena Vista Street in California Adventure. Upstate, they brought him out in the daylight. And the Headless Horseman looks stupid as shit. Like, immediately.
Fucking nerd.
Yeah, but truly, like, you bring out the Headless Horseman in the daylight, and you immediately go, well, the guy's head's tucked in, you know, under his shoulders. He's got a pumpkin. Yeah. The pumpkin looks weird. It looks like it's rotting. But you see it at night, and, you know, again, the Imagineers are very good at atmosphere and all,
sure,
that. But, like, you, sure, see it at night. I'm sure for you, working on a set, right? You know, well, you look at some of these things and you're like, well, of course, when it's out of the proper scene dressing, it looks silly. This movie is all out of the proper, you know, scene dressing.
Well, it's because what I said before. Mick Garris is a bad filmmaker. Like, I know this is it's a low budget horror movie. I get it. Yeah. And time is really of the essence when you make this shit. And that's how you can make daytime scenes look good or not. But he doesn't have the juice to make a daytime scene look good. Like, I know he loves fucking, like, standing on the shoulders of all the masses of horrors and like, oh, I'm friends with Landis and Hooper and Craven and all these guys, so I'm just like them. You're not. Toby Hooper, 20 years before this fucking movie, on a percent of the budget you had for this piece of shit, he made it, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, 90% of the movies during the day. And it's fucking atmospheric and creepy and unsettling. It's just, Mike, maybe, I don't know if Phil saw this, but I think a movie that this movie wants to be and really just cannot be. This
is movie a river feels runs like through it's it? Got,
well, obviously, because a river runs through Mad Dynamic when she sees Charles Bradley.
All right.
Hey.
That though, sorry, Tom, you make your point and then I will touch on the Mad Dynamic thing for a second because I've not touched on this.
Isn't this like the people under the stairs? Isn't this trying to like?
Yeah, absolutely.
Isn't it trying to capture
that's
crazy
a much better
like,
version of this?
Like, it's trying to capture that crazy like fairy tale in middle America tone thing, and also has a very specific Twin Peaks connection of Big Ed and what's her name, his wife in the show. Yeah.
As for Magic Dynamic, right? Tom keeps making jokes about just how horned up she is in this movie, and I think it is appropriate to make fun of insofar as like. First of all,
bug-eyed horny.
Yeah, like that's the thing. Like she is written the way that like the most hackish male porn writers write a woman feeling aroused. And it's extra troubling. Not troubling, but it throws you off because she's a pair. You know, the premise of the film is she is a virgin, right? Right. That's the whole idea. He's trying to steal her life force because she is a virgin, right? Okay. You need to do even a little bit of legwork and I'm not saying this, hear me out, right? If you are going to introduce a character who, like, We know nothing about her. We don't. The only time we see her before he shows up, right?
Mm-hmm.
The only time we see her before he shows up is her dancing to a song in the movie theater, right? We know nothing about her life outside of this. Now, cut to a much better film, right? Halloween. Yeah. John Carpenter's original Halloween. Sure. Yes, it is even less of a factor in the plot that Jamie's character is like much more innocent and virginal mm-hmm. than her friends. But John lays the groundwork to go, let me tell you who this person is. Let me give her a bit of more interiority, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we are introduced to Magic Dynamic and all we see is her dancing. This new guy she has never met shows up, right? Mm-hmm. And she's instantly like, you know what? That guy's hot. I want to get him in the sack. Yeah. I'm going to make horned up jokes about rubbing in the cemetery when he meets my mom. And my thing with that is it's just this thing of like, I'm having trouble understanding this person, right? Mm-hmm. I'm having trouble understanding, like, who is this person who is apparently mm-hmm. the most, like, virginal virgin in this town that the supernatural being who wants to feast on virgins is like, this is the most virgin person, right? Uh-huh. But also, you tell us nothing about her personality and nothing about what she sees in him to correct. Explain why the most virginal virgin looks at this guy and is like suddenly becomes, you know, Sandy at the end of Grease, right? She just has like, again, I'm not saying this is in like, oh, you need to tell me why she hasn't gotten like, it's more the thing of like, there is no effort to give her character any personality or interiority beyond being hot for him, which is why it doesn't make any sense that you also have this element of that's what I'm saying.
It's because like, if you're a virgin and you're like, I'm gonna finally get past this, you're gonna fuck for the first time in a cemetery.
That's
come
the
on.
Thing. It's you. No. And if
you want to fuck in a cemetery, you fucked before. You're not doing like, it for the first time.
It's true.
You're not doing it for the first time next to a guy who died in Vietnam.
Honestly, Tom, to your point though, if you're gonna do that and you want that to be the plot point. Right?
Sure.
Truthfully, you add in one scene where instead of her being like the Stephen King bubblegum pop dream girl, right? Mm-hmm. If you had her be more of a almost like a Lydia Dietz type, right?
Sure.
I'm a bit awkward, I'm a bit of an outsider. And then the cemetery element, real simple. Mary Shelley lost her virginity in a cemetery, right? Okay. If this guy, instead of preying on, let's face it, and again, and I'm not saying this just about appearance, right? I'm saying the way they style Madge Dynamic in this movie, everything. There is no effort to make her anything other than like the all-American girl next door. Whereas, like, right. If you make this, if instead you simply address it as like, he is going after the wallflower. He is going after, you know, we're going to make this character like a bit of an awkward and outsider. Like, that's all you need to do in order to make me go, got it. I get why this goes down the way it does. If he's the first person to ever, it's like, again, when Twilight even does this really well, where like they do establish like Bella Swan does not get a lot of attention. Bella Swan is a bit of a wallflower. Bella Swan feels awkward in her town, whatever. So when the new boy comes to school and this new boy is more interested in her than any of the pretty popular girls, that's all you need to go, got it. I get why she's intrigued by him. Right, I got this.
Yeah,
I get it.
And it's also like with the opening scene, it's unless I'm misremembering, they indicate that it's like a little girl that he ate and lived off of, and that's the body they found.
Well, like a teenager, she had braces on, so you know.
So that's like 12 or 13 or something. So you go, all right. So why are you going after her and making this so like? So much more complicated than it needs to be, which then adds to again how fucking terrible the script is. He before they go to the cemetery, he's trying to tell his mom, like, does it have to be her? And you're like, wait, do you actually like this girl? Yeah. Is that gonna be the story? Is that gonna be the story of the movie where it's like he falls for this girl and he's gonna fight with his mom to protect this girl? It's like, well, oh no, he's immediately going to like rape the shit out of her.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel as though they're tempted to go in sort of that direction, which again would have been more interesting and would have created a little bit of more, a little more tension in terms of that sort of situation. But ultimately, I think that Charles, once he devolves or evolves into that fucking beast creature, I mean, all bets are off. And then her being able to kill him by plunging her fingers into his eyes is nonsense.
Well, I mean, the scene where he turns into the cat guy after he attacks her in the cemetery, and she just keeps like stabbing him and beating him and doing this, it feels like an Evil Dead 2 scene of just, oh, look at, let's look at this guy get like walloped with, you know, increasingly comedic effects, and you just go, yeah, but like 5 seconds before this felt like a retreat at a Republican camp or something. Like, I don't know.
Yeah,
man.
It's, I mean, once the movie really kind of devolves into just essentially, I guess, the climax of the movie, which is sort of that all the housebound stuff and like sort of cops outside kind of, and like there's this detente that sort of has been created or whatever, then it just becomes kind of completely over the top. You've got her catching on fire, you've got cats gathering around the house led by Clovis. Clovis is just like rallying the troops. It's pretty ridiculous.
Which, by the way,
on fire.
I think that's kind of to the movie's problem, which is that's the best stuff in the movie, because at least it's got a deranged energy to it. We're like, oh yeah, he has blood and explosions and cats are just attacking this woman and shit. Where like the first fucking hour of this movie, you just go, like, who cares? Like, this guy is gonna eat this girl, and this girl's just like, oh, googly-eyed and being dumb, and you just go,
but like, at least I understood what movie I was in for like the first half hour, 40 minutes. And it just it really, you know, as we've sort of said, not to you know, belabor the point, but it just feels as though there's just not enough either mythological ballast or at least rules for us to sort of understand, that once it kind of just starts doing whatever it wants willy-nilly, you as a viewer, you disengage, because you're just like, well, if you don't care enough to like keep me locked into like what's like why things are happening, then why should I give a fuck?
It's also the fact that like it's okay to have it be willy-nilly if you are going to anchor us in Matchkinamic or one of the sheriffs or whatever. From the point of, you know, thinking about how do we kill these things, right?
Yeah.
We've shot it, we've whatever. How do we kill these things? If somebody is asking that question, right? Yeah. And the movie wants us to be like on their wavelength of like, hey, we don't know how to kill this thing. Instead, by that point, the movie takes the tone of like, hey, do you guys see this? They don't know how to kill sleepwalkers. And it's like, motherfucker, we don't know how to kill sleepwalkers. But you are acting like we all know how to kill sleepwalkers, but these things don't exist. There is no mythology for these.
And in the end, nobody still knows how to kill sleepwalkers, yeah, because she's just like, Madchen's just like, oh, thank God they're dead. How?
Yeah.
Thank you, Clovis. Yeah. Let's
That's
get
what I'm saying. Like,
here.
It's this whole movie works if it, you know what it reminds me of? And I may have brought this up on a different podcast, either this one or ours or something. And I'm going to digress for a second, but it makes a point. Tom, you remember when we were in like senior year of film school, and like our professor was very big on the idea of like everybody needs to edit their thesis films down, right? The shorter the better. That's what we all got told. 10 minutes is incredible. 20 minutes is good. Anything longer is bad. But a lot of the films that were being made ended up working out to about 30, 40 minutes, right? And you either had to fight with the professor to keep your film the length it was, or do what you're told, be the good boy, get the gold star. I'm not going to say their name. This could be a couple of people, but like there was at least one guy who kept editing his very ambitious film down. And he was very proudly boasting that he got it down to 10 minutes. Despite this movie being 40 minutes originally in his first cut, he got it down to 10.
And it made no sense.
That's the thing. He screened it, incomprehensible. And I remember like feeling, but I remember talking with him about it and like saying like, I didn't understand this. I didn't understand that. I didn't understand this. And he fully sincerely was just like, well, no, isn't it obvious that this? And I'm like, no.
Because he knew it because he fucking, yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, you know that because you've watched this 50 times in the edit bay.
Yeah.
I don't know that at all. I think we can sometimes be a little, look, I'm not saying test screenings are always good. I'm not saying test audiences are always good, right? But there are times where you hear people will be like, "I, you know, these test audiences are idiots." Like, yeah, you kind of maybe need to bring in some people who aren't so well versed in mythology or writing tropes or anything, because you've watched this too many times.
Yeah.
You've read this too many times. And Sleepwalkers has the tone of, well, everybody understands what Sleepwalkers are, because I know what Sleepwalkers are. And it almost feels like this was a movie where Mick Garris, if he had a question or was confused, right? Like, he would call up and go, "Hey, Steve, I don't know. It's not terribly clear in the script why the Sleepwalkers get blown up if a cat scratches them." And Steve would be like, "Well, let me explain it to you, because if you go to ancient Egypt and you look at this and you look at that," and he went, "Okay, got it," and hung up the phone, but doesn't change the movie, right?
Yeah.
That's the tone of this film, is like, that the people making it were like, "I fully understand what Sleepwalkers are," but there's no effort to make us know, but it thinks, it expects that we do know, so it doesn't bother to anchor us in the suspense. There's no suspense to this movie.
Totally. I mean, it's a big old fucking mess. Like, it's just, it's, and as much fun as some of it is, and I do agree with you, Tom, that like, when the movie's going full tilt, I don't give a fuck, it's fun, because as an audience member, you can just see that there's sort of a, there's a courage in that, right? There's a fearlessness in just trying to have fun.
I would almost say shamelessness. It feels like a movie that doesn't even know it should be ashamed at what it's doing.
Right. So I mean, all that being said, let's rate this, because I have a question for you guys to follow up after we rate this. I had not seen this film previously. I came into this movie at a 20. I think I'm sticking at a 20 here. I don't really have a whole lot of And basically 20 is for Madchen.
I had this at, it's not that big a change. Sure. I had this at about a 36.
Okay.
Now I'm at about a 34, which is not that big a drop. Yeah, but the only reason I note that is that when I was watching this and it made it at a 36, I spent the whole time just going, "This is so fucking stupid. Like, this movie's very stupid."
Yeah.
This is irredeemable. And in the course of our conversation, it's not like it made me like the movie less, but now talking about it, I have a lot more, "Oh, here's ways that this could have worked."
Sure.
Whereas before, I think I watched it and went like, "The minute you introduce incestual cat demons, I'm out." Now I'm like, "No, this could have worked under other circumstances," but yeah, I'm going to pop it at a 34.
How about you, Tom?
Oh boy. So I saw it at some point in the past, maybe high school or college or some point, because I've known this movie, I've seen this movie, rewatching it. Absolute delight. This is the exact kind of trash that I really love. I'm gonna do the objective.
Sure.
The objective rating.
And only give it a 98.
And only give it a 98. No. Objectively, I'm going to kind of pull what like a Kenny does sometimes, and I'm going to give it a 51, because I know it's not I know it's not good, but it's so not good in an entertaining way, and there's a lot you can talk about in how it's not good, but it's so entertaining, and unlike a lot of bad movies, you can't, even if you're like drinking with friends and like having a party with it, it's still not fun. Like, I'm not gonna watch fucking Terrifier 2 with my friends. If someone says let's watch Terrifier 2, I'm gonna say, "I'm calling the cops." I'm calling the cops and saying, "You have a gun." But like with this is so dopey and fun, and it's like the perfect just collision of Mick Garris's terrible abilities as a director and Stephen King's terrible, truly terrible screenplay. Like, he's written bad screenplays before, but they're based on shit he wrote already. So you kind of like, all right, something got lost in translation. This is where you just go, what were you even thinking when you sat down at your typewriter and just decided to crank this bullshit out? So you just got this unmovable object and this unstoppable force colliding to make...
Just like Batman and the Joker.
Yeah, exactly. The Batman and the Joker. Mick Garris has Joker hair. So this completely tracks. Yeah, he's got very long hair. If you dyed it green, he'd look like a very dapper Joker. Not, you know, he wouldn't be dancing in the Bronx. But I hate saying it. Mick Garris is such a nice guy, but he's a terrible filmmaker. Stick with producing. But this, 51 is my rating. Right. It's bad, but it's watchable.
So it's my question, I have two questions for you, and then I'll bring up what we're covering next week. But the question I have is,
I have one thing to note as well. But you do your questions.
Oh, great.
First,
okay.
That's okay.
Favorite Stephen King book. Favorite Stephen King adaptation.
Okay.
Go.
So I'll go first because sure. Because Tom is a much bigger King head than I, so I think he needs more time for that.
Sure.
My favorite Stephen King book is it's probably either. Carrie, I think, is the best book, right? Okay. I think, I look at that, and I'm like, it's just something that feels like a mini... I use this on our show a lot, but it feels like a mini miracle how it comes together.
Sure.
The very first Dark Tower book, The Gunslinger, is one okay. I'm partial to. Okay. It's not everybody's cup of tea, but it is one of the only King books that I've read more than once, because I find it just such an enjoyable, fascinating world that, speaking of mythology, it balances mythology really well. In terms of King adaptations, that's a bit trickier in some sense, because I don't necessarily like some of the ones that a lot of people love.
Sure.
I mean, it's not a good adaptation of the book, but it's a great movie, is like something like The Shining or something like that. But if mm-hmm. we're talking like that also connects to the book, I think I maybe have to go Misery. Because it's
a great movie. Yeah.
You know, just... Yeah, that's one that stands. I mean, Carrie's great too, but like that one really stands the test of time. Tom?
So for me, my favorite book is The Stand, the expanded mm-hmm. version with sure. all the added stuff where it's over 1,000 pages. I think it is easily his masterpiece. It does everything he does best, and I think it's a miracle of a book. Every character is great, every twist and turn is great. It is very prophetic. It feels very much like it could have been written yesterday, the way the world has kind of reflected the book he wrote. But if I'm going to say, I'm going to also say, like, if it's like a book connected to a larger thing, I'm going to say The Dark Tower Part 7 is also up okay. there, because I can't say like it's the best book. Like, you can't just go in and read it, because obviously it's the seventh book of the, but it's just such a perfect culmination of that weird, wild, wacky story where you never know where it's going to go. He never knew where it was going to go. Every book he wrote, he came in like, I don't know what it's going to be, but each book's different than the last, but it all somehow ties together. There's a few points in that book where it made me cry, and I'm not the biggest crier. You know, there's some stuff where he just has these emotional payoffs that are just so fucking great. The Stand and The Dark Tower 7 are my books, my go-to books. And in terms of movies, I'm going to say I think objectively the best is probably Shawshank. It's just, I mean, that's a movie like, you know, if it's on, it's on until it's over. Like, you're not walking away from the screen. It's a miracle of a movie. And kind of funny in, you know, context with Sleepwalkers and everything. The 90s were not a good time for Stephen King adaptations. We got Shawshank, and I know you guys don't like The Green Mile, but like it, you know, Green Mile got an Oscar love and stuff, and there are fans, me included, but they didn't make money. Like, you know, the Stephen King stuff in the 90s didn't work, and he started getting relegated to direct-to-video and TV sure. and shit. It wasn't really until the remake of It kind of blew everything back up. And you had that, and Flanagan started doing stuff where King kind of mm-hmm. came back. But if I had to say my favorite, I just rewatched it because a 4K disc of it came out, and I think it's The Mist. I think The Mist is such a fucking...
I gotta rewatch it. I saw it, and obviously everyone knows, you know, the ending is just like fucking brutal and awful.
Oh, yeah.
But I just, it's the Thomas Jane of it all that I'm just like, I just don't like that guy.
Phil, off mic, we'll tell you some Thomas Jane. We have encountered Tom, and we have a story.
I think Thomas Jane's a hit or miss when it comes to shit, but I think Darabont got he knew exactly how to use his energy for this role, and especially with how the ending plays out, I'm not going to spoil it for people.
I know the end. I've seen the movie.
No, but like he makes a big mistake. Because everyone talks about how brutal the end of the movie is. But what the brilliant thing about the ending is, it is the ultimate plea to never give up hope. Because if that fucking guy just held out hope for another 5 seconds, he would not have made this horrible mistake. And you believe this guy, you believe Thomas Jane making that mistake.
Yeah, I should watch it again. It is definitely one of, Darabont is just one of, it's funny because like, as I mentioned earlier, saw Shawshank, watched it with a bunch of friends at my place the other night. And it's just like, there's kind of nowhere to go from there for Darabont in a weird way. Like right out of the gate, you make this fucking masterpiece of a movie, whether you like it or not. I just feel like you make this kind of enormous thing. And then it's like, you know, I know that there are people like Green Mile. It's not really my
thing. Well, he tries to do it again. You know, Green Mile's just trying to do Shawshank again, and Majestic isn't a King thing, but it's got the same tone.
Right. And but then that's it's why the Mist,
I think,
and then it's
but
like,
that's why I think the but that's why I think the Mist is such a great move for him, is because he's not in Shawshank mode. He's not in, he's
that's
not
true. That's true.
He's not itching for awards love. He's making a mean, gritty fucking movie. And especially again, like I said it with The Stand, you watch it now. This movie came out in 2007. It feels like it was made post Trump. Where you just go, if it was made in 2017, you'd be like, okay, this is didactic. This is very obvious. Okay. In 2007, pre-Obama, you go, this is an interesting view of the world. Okay. And now you watch it. He got the world. He saw shit coming. He knew what was on the horizon. So yeah, Shawshank and The Mist. I will also special shout out to Gerald's Game. That is a movie that shouldn't work. Everyone said it's an unfilmable novel, and Flanagan kind of pulled off a real magic trick with that movie. Had to bring up Flanagan because Mike already brought up Reiner. And so, you know.
No, that's fair.
But what about you, Phil? Stephen King movies.
Stephen King movies, I mean, I'm hard-pressed to think of anything that works as well for me as Shawshank does. And again, you know, watching it the other night and seeing sort of the way that it's structured as a screenplay of all of these like wins and losses and the way that it's kind of compounding hope against the hopelessness is just pretty unparalleled. So I really do think it's a tremendous movie. I really love Stand By Me. I watched it relatively recently for a Double Bill Patreon episode and was really kind of floored by it all over again, just in terms of, you know, no one Stephen King's love of dirtbag kids just like is really kind of unparalleled. Like there's no one that loves just shitheads more than Stephen King.
It's pretty
amazing. And again, like sort of this gaggle of really sweet, big-hearted kids that are all kind of dealing with their own bits of trauma, paralleled with just this group of just, you know, fucking dirtbag shithead assholes that are just I really do think that possibly no one understands the darkness and the light of the human psyche as well as Stephen King does. And I think you made this point very early on, Mike, in terms of like, If we were able to sort of harness him a little bit better, you know, if he was able to harness himself a little bit better, like reading about the fact that like he had the idea for 11/22/63 like 30 years ago or something like that, like truly, you know, was this thing that he kind of and same with Under the Dome, even though Under the Dome may be less successful, but like of him really sort of mining away and making it a fucking diamond before it comes out. I think is something he should do more.
Well, that's why since that book came out, he's been on another incredible run. Yeah. Every book since he's written that book has been great. Yeah. Has been, you know, at the barest of minimums, like, oh, this is really good. Maybe not his best, but it's really good.
I have Fairy Tale on my bookshelf. I have Holly Fairy on Tale's my bookshelf, really which I'm excited
Holly's
to read.
Holly's really
as well.
Good. So Billy like, Summers is great.
I've heard Billy Summers is great.
Even though it's so funny, you can just tell he was watching Barry and said, Oh, I can do that. It's so fucking clear too. It's so funny that how it's just Barry, but his version of it. And you're just like, oh, Steve, I love you. You're just watching TV in your main mansion. And you said, I could do that. And he did. It's really fucking good. Also, shout out Creepshow.
Mike, you mentioned that you wanted to bring something up.
Well, before, I just want to, it's next week. Yeah, it's not about Sleepwalkers, but it is about us. It's about this whole show. It's about everything, if I may.
Sure.
You know, obviously, like I alluded to, last time we were on, things got tense. Things got a little tense here. And I've had some people ask, like, you know, like, oh, are you guys good? And I've had some people ask, like, are you still coming on for season four? Which I believe you are.
I certainly hope so.
I think we know what film, but I don't want to lock it in yet. Until we talk off mic. I don't want to say it now.
Yeah, we'll talk off mic.
Actually, fuck that. But I think we know what it is. But obviously, like, this was a nice moment of healing. This was a nice moment of getting back together. But I do think, Bill, there is... I do ask a little bit of extra atonement. And I'll explain what it is. this is going to be... This is currently my first year as a member of the Writers Guild. Right?
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I have decided that there is an appropriate way for us to make peace here for, you know, a bit of a mea culpa. So I want to make it clear on mic, Phil, that the way that we're going to make peace and break bread is much like the way that a confused elderly parent asks their child to explain the internet or how do I get to the next line on Microsoft Word. I want you to know, Phil, every time I am confused by a digital screener, every time I am confused about how any of this award stuff works, you are getting you are getting every confused email. And then I think that's our and then we're good. The air is completely clear. Just know you're gonna get me going. How the fuck does this Amazon MGM Roku app work? I have to put in a fucking code every time. Is this what does that mean? Does it, can I put it on more than one screen? What's the deal with this? You're gonna
I'll
get every
this,
one
though,
of those emails.
I welcome them gladly. I'll say that it is the interfaces for all of these passport screener apps are all kind of garbage.
I'm so confused.
It's all kind of a mess. And I'll also say, too, that, you know, it's funny. I've only received one physical screener thus far this year.
I think we got the same one.
Air, baby.
Yep. I got
Amazon's
the air one.
Just like, yep. Just everyone's like, you're getting air. Fine. so I think that we're going to see less and less physical screeners, which makes sense because very few people have.
Oh, I got the email about the Go Green initiative where I can opt out of the physical. And I'm like, nah.
Sure.
Because. I've
been going physically to screenings. I'm sure you know where all those are.
I'm missing Rustin tonight to do this.
Oh well, I appreciate that. Yeah. I do my best to try to go to the physical screenings when I can because I just prefer to see them on the big screen. But yeah, please bring it.
You're getting them all.
So next week on this podcast, we will be covering Unlawful Entry. Have you guys seen Unlawful Entry?
No, I just thought it'd be really funny if you describe. You were like, well, next week, and then you just named like one of the greatest films of all time. Oh. As though to just rub salt in the wound.
No, no, I'm not a total dick. Have you not seen Unlawful Entry, Tom? I'm a little surprised.
I have not.
Do you know what this movie is? Do either of you know what this film is?
No.
It's one of those fucking like psycho-like relationship
Is
ones,
a Judd
right?
in it? Is this a Judd?
No, unfortunately,
it feels like a Judd from the title.
It's a Kurt Russell, Madeline Stowe, Ray Liotta. Directed by Jonathan Kaplan. Kurt Russell and Madeline Stowe are married. Ray Liotta's a cop who they have their house broken into, and he's a cop who like has inappropriate feelings for Madeline Stowe, starts to become stalking them. It's really very ACAP. Like, it definitely is.
Are you telling me Ray Liotta is playing a guy?
I was
going to
do the same thing.
Very likable.
I was about to do the same thing.
God damn it. We're like an old married couple at this point.
But yeah, I mean, honestly, though, guys. Not a great movie, but not a terrible movie either. Like, there's a lot of, as you guys know, in sort of the hangover of the 80s into the 90s, we still were kind of still being given like movies for adults, right? Thrillers for adults. And this definitely falls into that category. And I was kind of watching it, as problematic as some of it is, it doesn't age well. It's 92. It's post, or it's right around the LA riots, if I'm not mistaken. So there's like kind of this whole, it's trying to tap into the socio-political environment in California and what have you, which it does not particularly well. But this is all just to say that it's still nice to watch these thrillers that were aimed at adults back in the 90s that got theatrical releases. This movie would be a straight to fucking Netflix movie if it came out today. But I highly recommend checking it out. But that's,
well, Kurt Russell's in it, and legitimately, I can watch that guy in fucking anything. He's one of the most watchable, likable fucking presences in cinema of the last like 40 years. Big part of why I'm going to watch that Godzilla show. I mean, it's Godzilla. Like, I'm going to watch it. That's my big chunky boy. I'm going to have to watch it. But Kurt Russell's in it. And my big chonky lizard boy. It's a big month for the big chonky boy, because he's got his own show coming out. He's got a new movie coming out. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love the brilliant. Finally, someone did the idea. What if Kurt Russell and Wyatt Russell played the same character at different times? No fucking shit. Cast Wyatt as Snake already.
It actually doesn't look terrible, I gotta say. Like, I mean, Apple definitely, Apple's like thrown a lot of money into it. So. Well, gentlemen, this was a blast. Obviously, I have questions for you off mic, so we'll have.
Longer than the movie.
We did.
Oh yeah, that yeah.
That is perhaps, you know, the beauty of this was Phil did not have a meeting to run to.
Oh Jesus! Can you tell our listeners where they can listen to you guys and your amazing
Absolutely.
Podcast?
Absolutely. So right now, unless this episode gets released many months from now. Right now, we have three complete seasons of our podcast. So You're Missing Out is a show about the National Film Registry. Every year, the Library of Congress selects 25 films to induct into the National Film Registry, films that are either culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. They've been doing this for, I think this is going to be the 35th year of the registry's existence when they come up this class. And what we are doing, Tom and I, and you know, usually with a guest, we are going through every single film inducted, induction year by induction year. If you are a fan of this show, you'll especially enjoy it, because it is just tradition at this point that the first episode of every season is Phil.
Just insane.
But
I appreciate it. I'm flattered. But it's
every insane. Time.
The first episode is Phil, and it's always about a crazy broad in old 40s Hollywood.
Only
two of them so far.
That was the one thing was that Sunset Boulevard, then All About Eve, then Chinatown, and redacted, but we're pretty sure we know what it is for this season, which is fitting with all of that. But we go through that, and we really try and bring folks on who have something to say about the films that make it interesting. This year, we talked about Lawrence of Arabia with Vice Victus, who is an Iraq war veteran. So he could bring that perspective to it. We're always trying to do something interesting in that regard. We've also got a YouTube channel now. If folks want to check that out, not only are the full episodes in audio form up there and some of the films you can stream, but we also have started to do commentary episodes. So certain films we actually will sit and record a full feature-length commentary track for. And if you go on our YouTube, if you've ever wanted to watch the Eric von Stroheim film Greed, you can watch the entire and it's the entire silent film, but the audio is us doing a commentary track for the film, which is a lot of fun. It's really, I mean, we've been having a lot of fun. We're about to start planning season four, and by about to start planning season four, I mean literally when this stops recording, we're gonna go, Phil, you're doing this, right? Yeah, good.
I'm looking at the movies from 1992, which is ironically the fourth year of,
yes, correct.
And I think I know what movie I'm gonna do.
I mean, you called your shot almost a year ago, and I don't know if you remember which one. Probably the same one. You called your shot on one, but we'll see if you've changed your mind.
Okay, we'll talk about it off mic, but I think
it wasn't Birth of a Nation. I just want to make everybody clear.
It is not
that Birth one's. Of a Nation. That one's thankfully sorted out. But you know,
congratulations.
In any event, yeah, that's gonna be fun. So people check that out. You can even follow us on TikTok. TikTok where we post like excerpt clips, and weirdly, for whatever reason, Tom performs better than I do on TikTok. If it's
Tom,
a clip of my voice,
it's funny because as you said TikTok, I was like, Tom on TikTok is either amazing, like in the sense that he just like totally hits a vein, or just fucking hates everything about it. So it's not a surprise to me that he is a success.
It's also this weird
don't
thing.
Don't get me wrong. I have nothing to do with it.
Yeah,
Mike is still,
as usual,
doing all the work. I'm not doing a goddamn thing.
It's funny. Tom started out being very anti-TikTok. He was like, it's just a bunch of teenagers doing dances and shit. I don't care. And I was like, this could be a new avenue for us. And since then, you know, as all TikToks do, like the For You page just starts to get flooded with a lot more like scantily clad women dancing and lip syncing, which has made me and my estimation of TikTok go down. But meanwhile, Tom is now going, you know what? Maybe this isn't so bad. Maybe this actually sounds like an interesting platform and an interesting exchange of ideas on
here.
Well,
you know, he sent me one of his tattooed, big titted vampire lady. I'm like, you know what? This is okay.
No, Phil, the only reason that happens is because anytime I go on and they're like, this is for you. I'm like, guys, we just posted a minute long video on the Battle of San Pietro. Why do you think this is for us? Your algorithm is wrong.
No. Like, counterpoint. I'm a part of the algorithm.
Yeah, that's true.
They know what they're doing.
It is just funny to like go and like see an R feed and it'll pop up like, what Roman Polanski was really influenced by was the French New Wave. If you look at the films of Jean-Pierre Melville, and then you flip up and it'll just be somebody going, let me tell you about my favorite sweaters. And you're like, what's happening? The algorithm is broken fundamentally.
The algorithm's not broken because the algorithm knows Tom Lorenzo's connected to this video. Boop, 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 boop. We're going to his Twitter page. Find a tweet. Please crush me with your legs, Rhea Ripley. Boop, boop, boop. He has a tattooed vampire lady. The circle. It's the circle of life.
That's the circle of life. It makes sense.
So check out the show.
So people can catch you there. They can listen to you on wherever people can find podcasts, I'm assuming.
It's on all the services. You're missing out on National Film Registry podcast.
Listen to it because I don't.
Yeah, that's fair.
Thank you so much, gentlemen, for coming on. Stick around because I have questions for you.
Fucking pleasure. Sleepwalkers. Scream Factory Blu-ray. Buy it now, asshole.
Is there a Scream Factory Blu-ray of it?
Hell yeah.
My Blu-ray is just Sleepwalkers packaged with Children of the Corn. No special features, no nothing. It's just like...
I mean, that also tracks.
Not even joking. Sleepwalkers is by far the better movie in that two-pack. Children of the Corn fucking sucks and it's boring.
It's really boring. All right, thank you so much, guys, and you'll be back again and it'll be great.
That's a threat to your audience.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.